chairs.
And she said that it's looked at, it's snowing again.
We had six bills, didn't we?
Jan?
We got only five?
Five. Five for introduction.
Gotcha.
We're on now.
I'd like to bring the House Business and Labor Committee to order. Monday, February 6th, we're going to start off with opening a work session for introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2991, dated February 1st, 2017. LC 3850, dated January 19th, 2017. LC 2888, dated February 1st, 2017. LC 2698, dated January 31st, 2017. And LC 2151, dated November 30th, 2016.
Representative Barreto moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2991, dated February 1st, 2017, LC 3850, dated January 19th, 2017, LC 2088, dated February 1st, 2017, LC 2698, dated January 31st, 2017, and LC 2151, dated November 30th, 2016. Any discussion on these measures? Again, committee members, voting to approve these as being introduced as committee measures doesn't mean you support or oppose the measure. It just allows us to have these introduced for further discussion at a later date. Is there any objection? Seeing none, no objections. The measures are introduced as committee bills. And we'll close that work session, and we'll move right into opening a public hearing on House Bill 2186.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that allows the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to certify self-insured employer groups that are created by intergovernmental agreement as a self-insured employer for the purposes of the workers' comp insurance system. There are no amendments before you, and this is the first time the committee is hearing the bill.
Great, thank you. And up first, let's have Hasina Squires and Frank Stratton. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires, and I am here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, a local government entity. Our membership consists of approximately 950 special districts who provide single services throughout the state of Oregon. Services including fire, water, sewer, parks, irrigation, libraries, and we are single service providers, unlike cities and counties. And one other thing that distinguishes us from cities and counties is that we are only given the powers. We have no home rule charter authority like cities and counties, and we are only given the power and authority that the legislature bestows upon us within the Oregon Revised Statute. And so that is why we appear today before you in support of House Bill 2186 that was introduced at the request of this committee during the interim. A little bit about our association. We were formed in 1978, and by 1985, we found ourselves in this situation with a number of our members questioning the cost of insurance, and we found it to be advantageous for us to pursue looking into self-insuring as a local government entity to provide lower-cost insurance services to our membership. In addition, the insurance carrier that most of our entities were using would not cover volunteers, and volunteers for rural fire protection districts are an essential tool for our small fire districts. So that was why we got into the insurance business, so to speak. So with that, we, in 1988, formed the association, SDAO, Special Districts Association, formed what's called an insurance trust under the provisions of ORS 30282. And that statute allows, and you'll notice that we're not amending ORS 30, we're amending 656. But that 30 statute allows two or more local public bodies to jointly self-insure via intergovernmental agreement. And that term agreement versus entity is where the problem has arisen. So at that time, we had tax ID number and certified with the department under special districts insurance services. And then a little over a decade ago, one of our attorneys and the workers' comp department, we jointly determined that we had the same tax ID number for SDAO and SDIS, and we were asked, which one do you want to use? And our attorney told us that it would be best to use the SDAO name and tax ID number, since that was the actual entity that then created the trust. And so we did that, and everything went along swimmingly until 2015, when our board and trust undertook a bylaws review, much like you heard the Credit Unions Association on your first committee meeting, to make sure all of our I's were dotted and T's were crossed. And as part of that, we pursued IRS 115 rulings to make sure that we were, in fact, actually tax-exempt public entities and obtained those rulings. But in the course of that, we were told then that we should not be using the SDAO name for the insurance services program, and that we should be using the SDIS Special Districts Insurance Services name and tax ID number with it. So we went to the workers' comp department and said, hey, we need to change our name back. We're then confronted with the issue of looking at the statute and what the statutory requirements were in 656 in order to be a self-insured public body. And if you'll look on page 2 of the bill, lines 18 and 19, it requires a ORS 190 intergovernmental entity to be that. That's how you would create a self-insured public body. And we cannot comply with that statute, and here's why. In order to do that, you have to have your local governments adopt ordinances. And ordinances are much different than resolutions. Ordinances allow you the ability to assess fees, penalties, fines, and not all of our special districts are afforded that opportunity in statute by the legislature. And so we had to pursue something different to make sure that we could continue to provide this important insurance low-cost coverage to our members. So what we did was collaborate with the with the workers' comp department to narrowly craft a fix in the statute. So we are adding just several words into the statute and referencing ORS 30.282 sub 3, which is an existing statute, Tort Claims Act statute, that allows for intergovernmental agreements. And all of our districts have all entered into intergovernmental agreements with our insurance trust by passing resolutions at the board level in a public process with elected boards of directors opting into our insurance program. And so we're asking you to just add those few lines into the those few words into the statute that will only apply to us at this moment, League of Oregon Cities, which is also a 190, but they also have city-county insurance services. They have ordinance authority, School Boards Association, and then the public universities, excluding U of O. And we believe that this captures the intent of the law, that local governments, self-insured groups, can, one, only be composed of local governments, and, two, that local governments have to agree to be part of the group via adoption of intergovernmental agreements. So it's a very narrow fix, and we urge the committee to support the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Nobody wants to touch this with a question, I guess. Maybe it's just, it is seems straightforward. So, Ms. Stratton, did you have anything to add? Or
no.
No?
That covers it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And Sally Cohen from Workers' Compensation Division, up to share a perspective, perhaps.
Good afternoon. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Sally Cohen. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services. I'd just like to follow up on the items that Hasina was talking about on House Bill 2186 to provide some additional background information. Oregon employers may cover their workers' compensation obligations by purchasing insurance from an insurance company or by self-insuring their liabilities individually or as a group. And the Department of Consumer Business Services is responsible for regulating and certifying self-insured employers and self-insured employer groups. This bill would allow public employers who have already established a self-insurance program for tort liability or property damage to form a self-insured employer group for workers' compensation, regardless of their authority to pass ordinance. Self-insurance programs for tort and property liability damage are required to meet similar financial and reporting requirements as are workers' compensation self-insured employer groups. And both of Oregon's currently certified public self-insured employer groups for workers' compensation also operate self-insurance programs for tort liability and property damage. We are aware of two other tort liability and property damage self-insurance programs that operate in Oregon, and they may become eligible to apply for certification as a self-insured employer for workers' compensation under this bill. This bill makes no changes to the requirements for self-insured employer groups that are made up of private employers. We have been working with proponents of the bill on this concept, as Hacina noted. They were certified as a self-insured employer group for workers' compensation almost 30 years ago, when requirements for intergovernmental entities were not as specific as they are today. When the situation that this bill addresses was recently raised with us, to be candid, unfortunately, our review process could have been handled a little more smoothly. This was an unusual and unique situation, and we really appreciate the flexibility of the proponents and their willingness to work with us on the language to help craft language to ensure it meets their intent and also our requirements. We are comfortable with this bill as drafted, and we have no concerns with it. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions on this one from the committee? Don't see any other questions on this bill, so thank you for coming forward and letting us know what was going on from Department of Consumer and Business Services. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill, House Bill 2186? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2186. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2192.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that increases the term for members who are appointed to the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee from 2 years to 3 years. And there are no amendments before you today, and it's the first time the committee's heard the bill.
Thank you. So let's have up Pat Allen and Luce.
Just me.
Just you.
Just.
Doesn't say just me on here.
Yeah.
but welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and just wanted to speak briefly to House Bill 2192. The Management Labor Advisory Committee is a nationally recognized critical component of Oregon's successful workers' compensation system. Representatives of management, the people who pay workers' compensation bills, and labor, the representatives of those who are at risk of injury and death on the job and who rely on benefits from the workers' compensation system, come together at the Management Labor Advisory Committee, or MLAC, table to advise the department and you on how to maintain a successful, healthy workers' compensation system. This has been actually a huge success over the last 20-plus years. Oregon went in the late 80s from having amongst the very most expensive workers' compensation insurance in the country, with some of the worst benefits, to today having the seventh lowest workers' compensation premiums and significantly improved benefits over time. You've perhaps read stories over the last couple of years about some states driving down workers' compensation rates on the backs of worker benefits. The story has been anything but that in Oregon. We've been able to move the system to something that works more quickly, that improves safety, that causes fewer people are hurt and killed on the job. There's less litigiousness in the system, and we've been able to steadily decrease workers' compensation rates, including a 7% pure premium decrease this most recent year. Service on the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which this bill is about, currently statutorily is limited to a 2-year term. which is relatively short compared to most bodies that are, as this one is, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. As you maybe got a little bit of a taste of in that last bill, and we'll get a taste of in a few more bills coming up, workers' compensation is highly technical and has a pretty steep learning curve. What this bill does is extend the terms of MLAC members from 2 years to 3 years. And we believe that's a worthwhile change that helps us take advantage of a member's ability to get up that learning curve and then be able to have some service for a period of time before they're required to roll off the committee. This would really kind of became a critical issue in the previous administration when there was an insistence on no more than two terms of service, which was 4 years, and that really became an awfully short period of time. The need to get up a learning curve and the need to find people who are willing to spend the amount of time, especially during session, reviewing bills and dealing with issues in workers' compensation, we think the longer term will help maintain the continuity and depth of experience that we need on this committee. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many serve on the committee?
There are five labor and five management members.
Follow up. I assume they're staggering when they come off.
That's correct.
One more.
Follow up again.
Why not go to a 4 year rather than just a 3 year?
Yeah, Chair Hulvey, Representative Hack, the committee considered that issue, and they were sort of balancing the notion of what's enough longer to relieve the too rapid turnover, but not so long that the term itself becomes a deterrent to getting people onto the committee. And so this was a period of time that the committee itself landed on as a good mix of the two.
Happy medium?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Not seeing any right now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think I'll bring up Nellie DeVries and Betsy Earls next.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. For those of you that I haven't yet met, AOI is a member-driven advocacy organization. We have approximately 1,600 members across the state, and those members employ roughly 200,000 Oregonians in different jobs around the state. We're appearing before you today in support of House Bill 2192, increasing MLAC terms from 2 years to 3 years. It's been our observation watching MLAC that two terms of 2 years is just, as the director mentioned, too short for members to be able to fully grasp the information that they need to make good decisions on MLAC and transfer that information to the legislature. MLAC is an absolutely crucial part of the workers' compensation process in Oregon, and we rely on it very heavily. We did talk about at one point increasing the terms instead of to 3 years, going to 4 years, and several of our members suggested, as the director just mentioned, that 4 years seemed a little bit intimidating if somebody was looking at 2 4-year terms. So at this point, I feel like we're pretty happy with 3-year terms if that meets the will of the committee, and we urge your support of the bill as it's written.
Thank you.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. For those of you that don't know, it is a nonprofit organization, trade association, comprised of certified, self-insured, and large deductible employers, as well as firms and organizations in business to provide services to the self-insured community. And in an effort not to completely repeat everything that was said prior to us, we are in support of 2192. We do agree that a 3-year term is a much more reasonable time, and for those reasons, the OSIA is in support of House Bill 2192.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer, question?
A comment, if I may.
Comment you may.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, too, and thank you for bringing forward this proposition. I just, as someone who served in the Senate in the previous century and was involved in the changes in workers' comp, I thought it would be appropriate with some new members to reiterate some things that I've said in the past. back when I served in the Senate back in the 80s and 90s, every session we had the workers' comp wars. And it was quite an ugly situation. And depending on who had the majority in the votes, things kind of shifted one side, labor side or management side. And it was ugly. And frankly, and I think it's fair to say and accurate to say that workers were the losers in that process. And we had the highest costs and the lowest benefits that in of. Well, at one point, literally the highest costs and the lowest benefits of any state in the entire nation. We've just about turned that completely around. And a huge piece of this is this labor management committee, because what we were doing was trying to manage pretty technical and complicated decisions in a legislative fashion. And they turned into partisan fights and bickering, I think, in my view. And that's not the way to run an effective insurance business, which is what, frankly, this is. This has worked remarkably well. And I think the one criticism in the 2 years was set originally because the thinking was keep it short, and that way you get good turnover and people don't get too staid and lazy. I think there was strategy in that at the beginning, but I think now we've learned that with turnover and occasionally with resignations, it doesn't leave you enough continuity. Mm. And I like this three-year compromise. I think it provides some continuity, and yet it also provides the opportunity for new people. And potentially it can be renewed, so you can have up to a six-year term. And frankly, at times, this can be a relatively intensive responsibility. So those people that commit to this commit to quite a bit. And I appreciate you indulging me and just kind of saying this, but I think it's helpful to understand the context, because otherwise you wonder, how in the world did this come to be, and is this really the way it should be, and how come we're in the insurance business, and all kinds of things. And I'd be happy to be offline or online to talk to any of you further about it if you have some questions. But I think the proof's in the pudding. Thank you for the indulgence, sir.
Thank you. Other comments, questions? Appreciate you testifying on this bill. Is there anybody else that wants to testify on House Bill 2192? Not seeing anyone. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2192. So now that we got the easy work done, I'm going to open up concurrently the next four bills, since it's mostly the same speakers. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2335, House Bill 2336, House Bill 2337, and House Bill 2338. And now I'll get the agency folks from DCBS, Patrick Allen, Lou Savage, and Jennifer Flood.
Great. Thank you, Welcome. Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Again, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by Lou Savage, who's the Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, and Jennifer Flood, who's the Ombudsperson for Injured Workers. And we're here to talk to you today about four bills. I already talked a little bit about the critical role of MLAC in the workers' compensation system and the success we've had in working together with businesses and labor to manage this system successfully over the last nearly 25 years. Just to add a couple of more bits of detail, particularly for newer members of the committee, the Department of Consumer and Business Services is responsible for running the overall worker protection system, and that is equal parts workers' compensation when bad things happen to employees on the job, and through Oregon OSHA, the primary prevention of injuries and illness on the workplace through inspections and consultation. We work to make sure that that insurers are providing benefits in a timely fashion and at the level that they're supposed to. We make sure that workers are treated appropriately in terms of the medical benefits that they need to receive. And I think most importantly, we work hard to make sure that employees get back on the job as quickly as possible, because when they're treated and gotten back to a stable condition and back on the job, their economic outcomes are much better. And that's better for the overall system. We also work hard to resolve disputes quickly and fairly. Representative Kennemer talked talked about the way things were back in the olden times. Often you were virtually at a place where individual workers' compensation cases resulted in individual bills to deal with how claims should be treated. Almost every case, it seems, at that time required some kind of legal intervention. We certainly still have legal processes in certain claims cases, but we're able to get a lot more of the system, a lot more of the claims resolved much more quickly and without that litigiousness. Today, we have four concepts to bring to you that continue our record of trying to make incremental improvements to the system. Two have to do with streamlining processes. Two have to do with benefits. And with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to Lou Savage first.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Lou Savage, I'm the administrator for the Workers' Comp Division at the State of Oregon. So I'm going to talk about three bills today, House Bill 2335, House Bill 2336, and House Bill 2337. The first bill, House Bill 2335, involves medical arbiter panels. So when a workers' compensation claim is closed by the insurer and the extent of the worker's permanent disability is determined, the worker or the insurer may request a review of the claim closure by DCBS. If there's an objection with the findings of the worker's impairment, the law requires the director to refer the claim to a medical arbiter for review. And the law also allows for either the worker or the insurer to request a panel of three medical arbiters to conduct the exam. So DCBS manages and coordinates the arbiter examination scheduling and the arrangements, and recruitment and retention of providers willing to be medical arbiters is an ongoing challenge, particularly with certain medical specialties and the rural areas of the state. As you can imagine, scheduling three arbiters for a panel examination creates additional scheduling challenges for both workers and providers. The worker must often travel at the expense of the insurer in order to attend a panel examination, as panel examinations are commonly scheduled in a metropolitan area due to arbiter availability. The department actually does not have statutory discretion to appoint fewer than three panel members to the exam. And there's actually very little legislative history as to why three arbiters were put into the statute. And so we are stuck, essentially, with appointing three arbiters. We really haven't seen any instances where there's been an issue with tiebreakers. Typically, the panel exam reports reflect a consensus of opinion, and there's usually not any dissent or disagreement among the providers. The lead arbiter actually writes the decision. So our history is that there really is not an issue with a tiebreaker. House Bill 2335 allows the DCBS director to select two or three providers, medical providers, for the arbiter panel, and it's based. It will be based on criteria that we will set in rule. So, in the case of a smaller panel being warranted, which would improve efficiencies, that's what we would intend to do, and this would be very effective, particularly in rural areas and where certain specialties are needed. Worker travel examinations will likely be reduced in terms of the time it takes, and the process will be more convenient and less expensive overall. We estimate that reduction from three to two panel members could result in insurer cost savings of up to, say, $275,000, $278,000 a year. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has reviewed this bill, and they do support it. Happy to answer any questions about this bill, or I can go through them all. We can take questions at the end, whichever you prefer, Chair Holvey.
I think we'll give the committee a chance to ask as we go along so they don't run these three bills together, which I would tend to do. Are there questions on this? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this takes it from three down to two, and you said that the lead arbiter writes the decision. Does that mean that he has authority over the other one then? Or?
No. Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, I guess I would compare it to an appellate decision. Oftentimes, there's a panel of three appellate judges. One judge is assigned to write the opinion. So it's a collective decision, but the lead arbiter is the one who writes the decision. I think there sometimes is some deference to the lead arbiter, but it is a consensus decision.
Yeah, follow up.
For a couple.
So on page six of the bill, it says line one, it says as many as three. And so they changed that wording, or added that wording, I guess, to where they can still have three, not mandatory two. And then you also said that there's never been an indecision in there, but there's always been three prior to this.
Correct.
Okay. So if there is they disagree, then what's the process?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, the arbiter panel decision is one piece of evidence in the decision. So I would say in the circumstance, which again has not happened before, there still could be a disagreement. But you're right. If with a panel of two, if in fact there was a split decision, that decision would just be part of the review process, and just like the other medical evidence that's part of the review. So I guess the short answer is it would not carry as much weight as if there was a clear decision, but it would be weighed along with the other evidence that's in the record.
If I could just expand on that a little bit, to be clear, even today with a three-arbiter panel, ultimately the department is making a decision in terms of what the contested issue is. And so that would continue to be the case, and if you will, if there's a split decision, we would look at that split decision and consider that in making the decision. I suppose effectively that would make the department the tiebreaker if that were to happen. I think in practice, if we were to start implementing this and start seeing a bunch of split decisions where we have not seen them before, we would be able to go back to a three-arbiter system, or if there's a particular type of condition or specialty where that's occurring, we'd have the flexibility to do that. But in general, we'd be able to rely on a two-arbiter system.
One comment. Well, I appreciate that. And I do appreciate the fact that they're looking at cutting $278,000 per year for the insurer costs. So thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to mention one other thing that I neglected to mention in the previous discussion, I believe the process, too, is that the Management Labor Committee approves of the bills that are forwarded to this committee regarding workers' comp, and that hasn't been stated. So I thought we ought to confirm that and maybe make that statement that all these bills come forward after there's been a discussion among the Labor Management Committee. That's why they play this very central role of balancing and compromising.
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Representative Kennemer, that's correct. And they did hear this bill, heard testimony about it.
Thank you.
Representative Evans. Thank you, Chair Holvey. I think part of the question I was going to ask was just asked, but in simplest terms, MLAC likes it. It's going to save money, and it will make it a faster process. Is that right?
That's my idea. Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, yes.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you for your presentation. I'm just curious, since it's in part to address a labor shortage of physicians, any thought to using nurse practitioners for some of the simpler cases?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, we have not looked at that. It's certainly something that we could look at. Historically, it has been physicians.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other questions? I noticed that the language of the bill looks like it would allow you to have one arbiter as well, as opposed to even two, which would then, perhaps cause some a little bit of concern, maybe. I don't know. Did that conversation come up?
So, Chair Holvey, I actually was anticipating this question. And
oh, good. I'm glad I could just fall right into that.
So when you look at the dictionary definition of panel, it is more than one.
Okay. I have to think about that. It's kind of left for interpretation a little bit, is what you're saying. But a panel, I suppose. I've been on panels of one before.
You won every decision, didn't you?
I did. So anyway.
You agree with yourself.
Okay, well, that was my only question.
Well, Chair Holvey, I appreciate the comment, and I think that to the extent that we need to clarify anything in rule, we could certainly do that.
Yeah, I guess I would just be concerned if you were just relying on one person. I kind of like the idea of having two points of view looking at some of these issues that are so important. Yeah.
Well, Chair Holvey, if I could just comment. I remember the initial context of this was selecting a medical arbiter, but that either the employer or the employee could request, instead of a single arbiter, a panel. And in that context of a panel being an alternative to a single arbiter, I think we would take the position that that would always be multiple arbiters.
All right. I'll go with that.
And again, Chair Holvey, most of these actually are one arbiter. This is the circumstances, as Pat pointed out, where either the worker or the insurer has asked for a panel.
Okay. As opposed to one person. Mm-hmm. All right. Just wanted to make that clear.
Shall we move on?
Unless Jennifer had something to add.
No.
Cool.
All right.
Okay, let's moving on to House Bill 2336. As mentioned earlier, Oregon employers can cover their workers' comp obligations either by purchasing private insurance or self-insuring their risks individually or as a group. And the department is responsible for regulating and certifying self-insurance for workers' comp. In 2014, those of you who were here probably remember that the legislature enacted Senate Bill 1558 at the request of DCBS. The bill focused on a specific urgent situation relating to the default of several self-insured groups to ensure that impacted workers were getting benefits in a timely manner. In the process of implementing the legislation, the department identified two areas where the bill inadvertently created some inconsistencies. The first involves claims processing. Under the 2014 bill, the DCBS director can immediately assign a claims processor for self-insured employer groups that are in default or decertified. This is to ensure that workers get their benefits as quickly as possible with minimal disruption. However, the way the law currently reads, it distinguishes between groups that defaulted or decertified before Senate Bill 1558, where we can immediately assign a claims processor, and those that may go out after Senate Bill 1558, where we cannot. For those situations, we need to use the state's procurement process. And as you may realize, this can be a time-consuming process, which can hinder the division's ability to ensure worker benefits are paid in a timely manner. So House Bill 2336 addresses this problem by allowing DCBS to immediately assign a claims processor for any defaulted self-insured employer or self-insured employer group, regardless of when the entity defaulted or decertified. The bill also covers individual self-insured employer because Senate Bill 1558 did not cover that self-insured employer. So this will establish a consistent process for claims processing assignment and will help to ensure the timely benefit payment for workers. The second part of this bill addresses damages from third parties. The current law allows workers with compensable claims or an insurer on their behalf to recover damages from third parties in certain situations. The classic situation would be an auto accident where the worker was on the job and they got into an auto accident. In that situation, the worker or the worker's insurer could file a lawsuit against a third party. So if damages are collected, the proceeds are distributed in a specific manner, including payments to what's called a paying agency. Under the law, the paying agency is the self-insured employer or the insurer paying the workers' comp benefits. DCBS is considered a paying agency only in very limited situations where the worker elected to bring the action, not the insurer, or DCBS has expended costs in very limited situations such as vocational benefit assistance or claims costs to a non-complying employer. But if DCBS pays worker benefits from other funds, sources for the employee covered by the defaulted or decertified self-insured employer group, DCBS cannot recover those funds. So if there's third-party recovery for one of these defaulted entities, the department is not considered a paying agency, and the recovered funds go to the self-insured employer or self-insured employer group that is defunct and decertified. So those public funds that are paid out actually don't get recovered under the current state of the law. So that is what this bill is meant to correct. The other piece of that is that if the insurer files the third-party claim, the law also doesn't allow DCBS to collect the funds, the public funds that were paid on behalf of the worker. So House Bill 2336 specifies that DCBS is a paying agency for respect to all of the expenditures of department funds and clarifies that reimbursement to the department is required no matter which party, the worker or the insurer, undertakes the third-party recovery action.
And after all that, you now know why we need three-year terms on MLAC.
Before you get to any questions, you also should have a copy of an amendment that we have asked for. We asked for this amendment to address an issue that came to our attention after we had finished work on this bill. The self-insured employer or employer group, when it files for bankruptcy or decertifies, is in a situation where we need to step in and we, meaning the department, contracts with a processing agent to process the claims. That agent is responsible for any disputes or litigation that arise out of that process. And typically, that paying agent retains its own private counsel if needed. DCBS is not directly involved in the claim processing or the resulting litigation, but we do reimburse the processing agent for some of the claims costs from department funds. So, for example, some administrative fees are paid through DCBS. The issue is that ORS 180220 requires that the Oregon Department of Justice have general control and supervision of all civil claims and legal proceedings, which the state of Oregon may be a party or may have an interest. So in the situation I just described, because state funding is used and the claim itself may be impacted, it could be interpreted that DOJ is required to supervise or even direct and control the administrative and legal functions of a private entity. So just to make this clear, the claims processor may have a dispute involving the claim, and the law currently could be read to say that the Department of Justice would be representing that independent claims processor. The difficulty is that with that is that the department itself may seek advice regarding a dispute with that claims processor, because we, in fact, have a contract with that claims processor. Or if there's litigation, we would be asking the Department of Justice to represent us. So it's possible that a potential conflict of interest could arise in a situation where the Department of Justice has given advice to the claims processor and now has to turn around and give advice to the department on an issue where there may be a dispute between the department and the claims processor. So this amendment allows the claims processing agent that contracts with DCBS to employ its own legal counsel and basically take the Department of Justice out of the picture in terms of representing the claims processor. Now, this is, already the situation for claims processing agents that we contract with to process claims for non-complying employers. So this change is consistent with the way the statute is written for claims processors who do the non-complying employer claims. Now, the Management Labor Advisory Committee has looked at this bill, but because we have asked for this amendment, it will now take another look at it and will give you their input, well, by next week, because we have a meeting on Friday.
Great.
Questions about this bill? I know it was a mouthful. I tried to simplify it as much as I could.
So, questions? Like you're driving everyone away.
So nicely explained.
I'm observing.
You're doing a good job. So
last bill that I'm going to talk about, House Bill 2337. One of the primary goals of the workers' compensation system is, and I'll just quote from the statute, to restore the injured worker physically and economically to a self-sufficient status in an expeditious manner and to the greatest extent possible. So one way that we fulfill this mission is to compensate a worker for a permanent loss of use of a function due to their work-related injury. So this bill was written with two parts to it, permanent partial disability benefits and permanent total disability benefits. I'm going to start out by telling you that a portion of that bill has an amendment. We've submitted an amendment to take the permanent partial disability piece out of that bill. We plan to spend more time evaluating the permanent partial disability piece. And we may seek a change at a future time. So with the amendment, the bill just has the permanent total disability benefit piece to it. So that's what my testimony will focus on. So workers who are permanently incapacitated from regular work and gainful and suitable occupation receive this permanent total disability benefit. The current minimum benefit is 90% of the worker's wage or $50 a week, whichever is less. The maximum benefit is 66 2/3 of the worker's wages, subject to a cap of 100% of the state average weekly wage, which is currently $974 and change, $972.74.20. And just so you know, there's about 600 existing permanently and totally disabled workers in the system. There's only about 10 new awards per year. It has varied between 8 to 12 over the last few years.
If I could just interject, occasionally there's confusion when you talk about total disability between this program and Social Security disability, which is a completely different program with completely different standards. This, as Lou says, is a handful of people per year found to be totally permanently disabled.
So House Bill 2337 increases the statutory range for permanent total disability. The bill increases the minimum benefit to 66 2/3 of the weekly wage of the worker, or not less than 33% of the state average weekly wage, and it's an amount that approximates the federal poverty level for a family of two. So. So just let me give you some numbers here so it makes a little more sense. The current statute, again, it's 90% of the worker's weekly wage or $50, whichever is less. House Bill 2337 is 66 and two-thirds of the worker's weekly wage, but no less than 33% of the state average weekly wage, which is $321.50. So that would now be the new minimum, is $321.50 per week. So we also are increasing the maximum. So the bill increases the maximum permanent total disability benefit to 133% of the state average weekly wage, but retains the basis of the benefit at 66 and two-thirds of the worker's wage. So again, I'll go back again on this. So at the current state of the law, 66 and two-thirds of the worker's weekly wage, but no more than 100% of the state average weekly wage. That is, if I get that for you.
About $900.
Yeah, about $974 a week. So the current state of the law, that would be the maximum that a high wage earner could make. Under our proposal, House Bill 2337, it would still be 66 of the worker's weekly wage, but now it would be no more than 133% of the state average weekly wage, which is no more,
about $1,300.
Yeah, $1,300 a month, right.
A week.
Oh, excuse me, a week. Let me give you a couple of examples on this. And again, this is the high wage earners. So if someone was making $80,000 a year, 66 and two-thirds of that wage would be around $1,022 a week. 133%, which is the maximum, would be $1,295 a week. They would get the 66 and two-thirds. Let's say someone was making $100,000 a year, which is about $1,915 a week, $1,915 a week. 66 and two-thirds would be around $1,277 a week. 133% again would be $1,295 a week. Again, they would get the 66 and two-thirds. Because they hadn't reached the maximum. If someone was making $150,000 a week, this is where the 133% cap would come in, because 66 and two-thirds would be $1,915 a week, which would be more than 133%. So they would be capped at the $1,219 a week. Hopefully that example explains it a little bit more. In terms of the cost, as I mentioned earlier, there's very few of these folks who are permanently totally disabled every year now. The cost to the system, to the insurers, is less than $50,000 a year system-wide. The bulk of the increase will be picked up by the Worker Benefit Fund, because it would go to pay retroactive benefits. That cost is about $1.7 million a year, again, out of the Worker Benefit Fund, which is the cents per hour that both employees and employers pay out of their paycheck. The fund, the Worker Benefit Fund itself, can absorb this. We've done the numbers on this, and it's not going to have an impact on the cents per hour. The fund is in really good shape, and it would not necessitate an increase at all.
In fact, we just reduced that fund with a view toward the analysis here as well.
So the Labor Management Committee has looked at the bill, but it did not review the bill with the amendment, which takes out the permanent partial disability piece of the bill. So they, again, will be looking at this on Friday and will be giving you your input as early as next week. Any questions about this bill?
Questions from the committee? Representative Fahey.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how you arrived at the one-third minimum and the 133% cap? So why one-third and not 25% or 40%? Or
the well, that's a good question. The 66 and two-thirds, that percentage is consistent with other and other benefit calculations. And I would say, Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey, I would say it's a historical number to make it consistent with other benefit amounts. I could get back to you as to what that historical context is. I could not tell you today.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up?
What about the 133% cap? Why cap it at 133 and not some other number?
Jennifer is reminding me, Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey, I think that's temporary total disability.
That is correct.
Yeah. So we're trying to make these percentages consistent with other benefit levels.
So Jennifer, could you identify yourself?
Sure. Jennifer Flood, Ombudsman for Injured Workers with Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Barreto? Or Representative Fahey, did you have another follow-up? Representative Barreto.
So if this bill were to pass, does this just cover people that are injured from here on out, or is it retroactive to all of those on the system right now?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, no, there is a retroactive piece to this, and that is the portion that the Worker Benefit Fund picks up. So the figure that I gave you, the $50,000 a year,
right,
system-wide, that is the cost for insurers going forward.
Okay. The 10 people per year.
Exactly. Yeah, the 10 new people a year.
Can I follow up that?
Follow up?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the people that are making $50 a week right now. That was my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Retroactive to those. I'm just asking, yeah, if it's from here forward or if you're covering those that are already on $50 a week.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, the answer is yes. We're picking these benefit increases will be retroactive to anybody who's impacted. And I guess I should point out, too, that most of the folks who are on permanent total disability will not be impacted by this change because they are neither the minimum nor the maximum. Other questions?
Other questions?
And we'd like to.
I will just have one. You know, I was just, if you look at Section 3 of the bill, it does say it applies to injuries occurring on or after the effective date of this 2017 Act. So how do you make it retroactive to injuries occurring before the date of this Act?
Chair Holvey, we have.
Or am I just, is it just talking about specific sections that don't impact that?
Right. We actually have a retro reimbursement process that we go through for bills like this, and we bring that benefit up.
Okay, I'll go with that for now.
If you'd like, we can move on to the last.
Yeah,
Bill,
please do.
Just quickly, we've talked about different things that have been changed over the workers in the workers' compensation system over the last 20 or 25 years. Talked about the creation of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. Another key component of that reform were the creation of two ombudsman functions within the agency that are separate from the workers' compensation division that report directly to me. One is the small business ombudsman, who helps small businesses deal with a variety of issues related to their ability to get coverage in the workers' compensation system. And then the Injured Worker Ombudsman, you've met Jennifer just a bit ago. Jennifer fulfills that function, and she and her staff work with injured workers separately from the Workers' Compensation Division to help them navigate the system, advocate on their behalf when necessary. And I'd like to ask Jennifer to talk about House Bill 2338.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Jennifer Flood, Ombudsman for Injured Workers with DCBS. I am here today to testify on House Bill 2338, which streamlines the monthly benefits for monthly survivor benefits for children of workers who have died as a result of an on-the-job injury or occupational disease. I have the privilege of working with workers and their families every day in explaining the workers' compensation system, so this bill is a little near and dear to my heart here. My written testimony includes a chart that gives you the basic differences between what the current statute provides and what the improvements in House Bill 2338 would be doing for our Oregonians. Fortunately, through the efforts of many, on-the-job fatalities are rare, but to those families that are forced to deal with such a loss, the effects can be extremely devastating. And although the workers' compensation law has evolved to address changes in societal and family structures, the patchwork that has taken place over many years has resulted in a benefit structure that is confusing and difficult to administer, let alone explain to beneficiaries or make them predictable for those families. Children of the same worker may have different benefit amounts in different durations, dependent on several circumstances. Fatal claims, as I mentioned, they luckily are not very common. There's approximately 30 fatals every year. Of those fatal claims, about 55% have surviving children that are entitled to benefits. The total existing claims that are currently in our system include about 310 surviving children at this point in time. We are working on an amendment. It has not gone through as of yet, but that amendment is specifically to ensure that the applicability will apply also to the existing claims, that it's clear that the actions of the director and the workers' benefit fund will make up the difference for those claims that are falling short of what this bill does for those claims that are already in existence. This House bill does have three primary changes to the law. The first one is it would create one monthly benefit for all children of the deceased worker. Currently, there are two levels, and it's determined by the marital status and living arrangements of the worker prior to their death. Some examples of that, if a worker leaves two children, one that primarily lived with them and their current spouse, and the other child living with their ex-spouse, one child would receive a 10% benefit, the other child would receive a 25% benefit. However, if the worker chose not to marry but had the same living situation, both children would be receiving 25%. Okay. Chair Holby.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Just Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure I understood. So if you're not married, there's a benefit?
In this situation, that is correct.
Yeah. Really? Thank you.
Yeah, okay. If you don't think that makes any sense, you're on to something.
Yes, you are.
Just want to make sure I heard it right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So creating one level would treat all children equal, and it would take out the determination and judgment of the workers' choices of their living arrangements and lifestyle choices. Okay? You want me to move through the different ones or take questions as we go along? Just move along.
I don't see any questions right at the moment, so keep going.
So the second area is setting a standard end of eligibility age to the age of 19. Current statute sets the standard of the age, of the benefits to end at age 18 or 19 or somewhere in between. Okay, and it all depends on the age of the child when they leave high school. Example, our worker has three children. When the child turns 18 the week prior to leaving high school, they'll get benefits till the age of 19. If the child turns 18 the week after leaving high school, their benefits end that next week at the age of 18. And if the child happens to be 17 and a half when the worker is killed, that child would receive benefits until they were 18 and a half. In today's education system, there are numerous variables: early graduation, year-round schedules, homeschools, last day delays due to inclement weather. Just saying. Okay. Standard benefits, I believe, should end the same for all children, and it will make it predictable for the family as well as the insurer that's processing these benefits. And then the final primary area that this bill affects relates to the structure of monthly benefits to a child attending higher education. This bill creates a flexible benefit for up to 48 months while attending higher education from the age of 19 to 26. The current statute does provide benefits while a child is attending higher education, but it's very archaic and rigid, causing unpredictable eligibility and potentially leaving children without the ability to pursue education in college or trade school. Examples are they have to be 18 when they leave high school. They have to enroll and attend within 6 months of leaving high school, and then the benefit ends and cannot be restarted if they stop attending, graduate, or become 23. Some examples where workers or children would not receive benefits is if there was a delay in attending higher education. You know, they might decide that they're not certain what they want to do. They don't start until the following January after graduating in June. Those children would not be receiving benefits. If they need to build up funds to attend college and don't enroll within 6 months of leaving high school, they would not be able to receive benefits. And then with the current system, if there's an interruption in attending due to health, due to changing schools, religious commitments, or financial hardship, once they stop attending, they cannot go back and start receiving benefits. So the flexibility of House Bill 2338 will give every child of the deceased worker the opportunity to receive monthly benefits while attending higher education. It also provides benefits if they have not completed their high school degree, they're 19 and they want to go and get their GED. This bill will also cover benefits for them while they're doing that. I believe House Bill 2338 will provide predictable, streamlined delivery of monthly benefits to these children whose parent left for work one day but unfortunately did not return home. I'd be happy to address any questions.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
That last part about education, you said so they wouldn't receive benefits if they delayed college and waited a year, or if it was interrupted by health issues or mission field. But if they went to school within 6 months and it took them 6 years, well, let's see, 26, it took them 8 years to get through, that's okay.
Well, actually, and I need to make a clarification, Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, they end at age 23 when the worker child turns 23. With the current law, they have to enroll within 6 months of leaving high school, and then they receive benefits as long as they continue in higher education to the age of 23. This concept says, okay, take out the whole 23, make it 19 to 26, and they get 48 months anywhere in there.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it.
There's the flexibility. Yes, Representative Fahey.
Really appreciate the simplicity and the consistency involved in the new approach. In terms of the percentages in the second column of your written testimony, you know, is there a rationale for going with 25% of the average weekly wage? You know, right now it's either 10 or 25. So, and the same thing with the duration of the benefit until somewhere between 18 and 19, and you went with 19. Can you just talk a little bit about?
Sure. The reason why I suggested the 25 is because it was the higher benefit of the two, and I didn't want to create a system that would be lessening the benefits for any of the children. And the reason, the same applies to the age of 19. Many kids get benefits now until the age of 19 if they were in high school when they were 18. And again, not wanting to decrease the benefits to the existing children.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't. Just to sum up, if I may, 2335, you have MLAC's endorsement in hand for that bill, 2336, 37, and 38. They've seen the bill. Express no concerns, but we'll be acting based on the final amendments Friday, and we'll be able to have you their recommendations prior to a work session.
Great. Appreciate that. Appreciate your testimony today. And
thank you.
Bringing these forward bills forward. So I'm leaving the public hearing open on these four bills, 2335, 2336, 2337, 2338, and we'll have up Nellie DeVries and Betsy Earls.
So.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. For House Bill 2335, we are in support of as many as three medical arbiters. We do believe, as our predecessor stated earlier, that it will streamline the process for claims and ensure that workers are compensated in a timely manner. As we know, in rural areas, it can be very difficult to get those three medical arbiters in the location at the same time, which just creates a very long, lengthy process. So we really think that this would benefit injured workers and employers all in one. So.
And for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries again. And as my colleague stated, their reasons for support on House Bill 2335, AOI is also in support of 2335. We have several members, we have many members in rural areas that would appreciate the flexibility that this bill offers with medical arbiter panels. So we urge your support.
Okay. Moving on to House Bill 2337, if that's okay. Are there any questions?
Go ahead.
Okay. For House Bill 2337, currently the Oregon Self-Insurers Association is in support of the Dash 1 amendments that have been offered up that would remove the permanent partial disability from the bill and solely increase the permanent total disability compensation. And so with that amendment, the Oregon Self-Insurers Association will also be in support of 2337. And finally, for 2338, we'll just go down the whole list. This is the fatality benefits. Oregon Self-Insurers Association, again, is in support of the bill. We believe that it's really a great opportunity to streamline the process and have a uniform standard for children of injured workers and in these fatal, terrible opportunities. Not opportunities, but terrible accidents do happen. So that, all right.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. And AOI very much appreciates the willingness of Workers' Comp Division to take out the permanent partial disability section of House Bill 2337. Our Workers' Compensation Committee is looking at that bill very shortly, so I can't tell you that we're actually in support of the bill with only permanent total disability increases, but I expect that that will be the case. And as to 2338, we're also looking at that bill very shortly, and at the very least are neutral on it, and we'll probably be before you in support of it before it moves.
Great. Questions from the committee? So can I I'll ask a question about the amendment. So pretty certain you're organizations wouldn't be in support of the bills with that without that amendment?
Mr. Chair, Betsy Earls from AOI, no, we would be opposing House Bill 2337 if the permanent partial disability increase was left in the bill at this point. Although that might not be the case forever, we would appreciate seeing more data on that situation. And we've talked with the director about that.
Right.
Yes, and Nellie DeVries, Oregon Self-Insurers Association, we echo AOI's sentiments in terms of we would oppose the bill currently, but are open to having more conversations.
Thank you for that clarification. Up next, I have one more person signed up to testify, Tim Cowan, on House Bill 2336.
Chair Holvey, committee members, my name is Tim Cowan. I'll be real brief since I wrote some notes and gave to you. The reason for my interest in 2336 was it talks about self-insured. It does not talk about private insurance companies. And if you take a look at my written testimony, I don't know if employees understand what workers' compensation is and how they're covered. Even though companies are required to post it, I think, on a reader board, I've never read it, and I never attended a meeting that explained it to me. When I started my own company, there was an insurance form that had two boxes in it for if management wanted to be covered or not covered. And I found that interesting because in the state of Oregon, You can only be one or the other. Because in the case of the company that I took out, you couldn't be covered. In fact, management couldn't be covered and owners couldn't be covered. And I didn't find out until I had a traumatic brain injury, and then it became an issue after about 10 to 12 years after I purchased it. And I found it intriguing because when I bought it, I was the only employee. A couple of my questions is that there was never any meeting held when I was an officer in the bank that explained what workers' comp was. There was never discussion on when I got promoted, did it impact workers' comp? Because what I understand in my insurance coverage is as you moved up, it would not cover management and or ownership in the company. So when I paid, I'm going to guess, I don't want to tell you how old I am, I probably paid over 40 years into workers' comp out of my checking, my payroll check, and I have no idea right now what it was for because I was not covered. And I don't know if that provided me coverage for workers' comp. I don't know. And I think it would be really funny to go out and have a questionnaire for employees to have them explain what workers' comp is and whether they're covered. I just wanted to, the 2 points I brought up, 2336, is it talks about self-insured. I would just like you to remember, how about private insurance companies? Because it could very well be that people don't understand what that means. That's all I have, Chair Holman.
All right. Well, thank you for giving us your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Cowan?
Mr. Cowan, thank you. I'm sitting here as an employer, and I pay both a premium for workers' comp, and we also pay workers' benefit fund. I have no idea. I just know that I write the check, and so I understand exactly where you're coming from. And as we go through our renewal process, I'm also asking those same questions. What exactly are we paying for, and what exactly are we getting? So I 100% understand where you're coming from.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Well, thank you very much for providing us your testimony. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2335, 2336, 2337, or 2338? I'm not seeing any, so I'm going to close the public hearing. House Bill 2335, 2336, 2337, 2338. Jan, do we have any other business for the committee?
No business. Thank you.
No more business for the committee today. I think Wednesday we're likely to see some bills up for work session that we heard in our first day, so I'll probably be talking with my vice chairs about those to see what kind of concerns anyone might have. So if you have concerns, let your vice chair know.
Okay.
So with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.